Well, now to A Foreign Affair, where each month we banter with people, use that as a verb, who are expert in all things beyond our shores and the role that they might play inside our shores. And we invite some key guests to nominate some global events that resonate with them. This week we're joined by Tamerlane Beasley. She's a board member of the Australia-ASEAN Council for the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. She's a founder of Beasley Intercultural. It's a cross-cultural training and consultancy company and it's just celebrated its 20th anniversary. Hello, Tamerlane.
Hello.
And from the Financial Times, Jamie Smythe, the newspaper's Australia Pacific correspondent who came to us via Ireland. Welcome, Jamie.
Hello.
And Nicholas Farrelly, lucky if you're in his classes at the ANU, he's a specialist in political conflict and social change in mainland Southeast Asia. He's also the Associate Dean in the ANU College of Asia and the Pacific. Hello, Nick.
Hello, how are you?
Lovely to have you all join us. Now, Jamie, you're kicking off with the biggie, I suppose, President Trump's speech this week on a new strategy in Afghanistan, in which he explains the limits of America's mission, saying, mind you, that they're going to ramp up their numbers, but that the US would be focused on going in there to kill terrorists in his inimitable style. He says he wants an honourable and enduring outcome that is worthy of the sacrifice that Americans have put in, and that the rest is up to the Afghans. Here's a small excerpt.
The stronger the Afghan security forces become, the less we will have to do. Afghans will secure and build their own nation and define their own future. We want them to succeed, but we will no longer use American military might to construct democracies in faraway lands or try to rebuild other countries in our own image. Those days are now over. Instead, we will work with allies and partners to protect our shared interests.
Now, Jamie, what struck you in terms of his renewed aspiration?
Well, I think this was a really interesting speech from Trump, the president that said he was going to put America first and remove America from foreign entanglements. But what was seen as a major U-turn here with his speech in Afghanistan, this is a war that is America's longest ever war, 16 years, more than 2,000 US troops have died. And everyone was expecting Trump to remove America from this conflict. But what he's done is, I think he's realized the political difficulty of just exiting Afghanistan. Mm. And he's set out terms for America to remain engaged. But what he hasn't done, he hasn't specified how many new troops that they're going to send to Afghanistan to fight this conflict. He hasn't set out any timelines for how long the troops are going to be there. And he hasn't set out any particular goals. So actually, we're in a bit of a limbo in terms of policy.
Well, we want them to succeed. I mean, we all do that, I think. But I noticed that the head of the Afghan army said, I hope they're sending people who can fight and not just advisors. Imagine what difference it would make if they could fight beside us. This is what the Afghan chief said, because they're losing provinces, particularly Helmand, which have claimed so many allied lives, and they say they'll recapture them. You know, you wonder what is realistic.
Well, the Afghan government controls about half the country, which is, I think that shows the scale of the challenge that the allied forces face in Afghanistan. And as you mentioned, the British Empire and the Russians have both tried to take over Afghanistan, and it does tend to end up the graveyard of foreign enemies. So the problem is, if they removed themselves unilaterally from Afghanistan, the fear is, of course, that it's going to become a haven for terrorists again. So really, they've got themselves in a halfway house here. They're not prepared to put in enough troops that it would take to actually make huge strategic advances. You know, Obama back in 2009 announced the surge and put in 100,000 troops, which actually did tend to make a lot of progress. But here, we haven't been told how many troops, but leaks have suggested it's going to be about 4,000. And that means that mainly it'll end up being trainers, advisors, rather than US and allied troops on the ground.
So Nick Farrelly, the other part of the speech, which was really pretty blunt, and if anything has got people sort of more stirred up, was the way he talked to Pakistan and about Pakistan. And it was only in an interview I did last week about Indian partition that I realised that the Afghans are very close to the Indians, and Pakistan feels encircled by these two sort of big groups. And I don't know what's going to get them out of that mode.
Well, of course, Geraldine, what the Pakistanis have sought to do is to find an angle here through their Chinese friends and collaborators. And so that gives Pakistan a bit of leverage. They, of course, are concerned that India remains unfriendly and will continue to seek to undermine Pakistan in every aspect of national power. Afghanistan is an area where the Pakistanis have proved themselves to be agile, perhaps often to the detriment of American and other allied interests. And the statement from President Trump was about as blunt as we've heard.
It was.
I guess the question now is, to what extent is he going to be prepared to follow through on that? And it could have all sorts of ramifications.
So I think it's really interesting in that his bluntness and his directness, he doesn't seem to understand that people are often expecting to be able to read between the lines. When he says something, he's so direct. Whereas, for example, when we work with Chinese clients, often they'll say to us things like, how do we know what Australians really mean when they say this? And our response is, well, they really mean what they're saying. No, but what they really mean. No, that's what they really mean. And I think this is where that lack of nuance can be a challenge, and that there's not much dog whistling going on in terms of Trump will say what he says. Yeah. But in so many other cultures and so many different parts of the world, people are expecting a bit more nuance and a bit more hinting and a bit more wriggle room. So there's very different cultural approaches to communication going on here too.
See, it's interestingly, because when you look back at the history, because, you know, India and Pakistan turned 70 this month, you realise that there's this deep-seated suspicions, as people said, Pakistan wasn't even really supposed to become a country. And Pakistan is, you know, it's an army with a country rather than a country with an army. It's a most unusual place. And so if India and Pakistan could find a way to stop being so super anxious about each other, we'd be in a new world. No one seems to be able to broker that.
And it's how do you bring people together to actually have the conversation they need to have, given history. And I think particularly in Australia and in the West, we often forget about the significance of history and the fact that if you've been had a certain experience, and I think this is quite pertinent with what's going on in the US at the moment, you can't just forget about that. So that shapes the way you perceive and engage with others.
Can you imagine the language being different, Jamie, given that he is still got the biggest military? This is President Trump I'm talking about. So when he's speaking, I suppose he's, in fact, that did sound remarkably thoughtful and cautious, didn't it, for him in some ways?
Well, actually, this speech was quite interesting because he used a teleprompter, one of the few times he's done that.
I could hear that.
It was quite measured. And actually, I think most people thought it was probably one of his best speeches. But now he's got to put, you know, the money where the mouth is. He's got to decide, does he start withdrawing aid from Pakistan? Mm. How does India get brought into this? And is there a danger of wider regional tensions through that? These are all really complex issues. And when you've got Trump, who tends to be flip-flopping between different policies at the drop of a hat, you've got to ask yourself as key allies, are you prepared to put your troops there? That will be a request that I'm sure is coming. New Zealand on Friday have suggested that they're going to provide 3 extra troops. Not very many, but I think Australia could well get a request for many more.
Nick Farrelly, you're used to working in the Southeast Asian region, but I'm betraying, I suppose, a frustration, a very Australian frustration, that people can't find a new set of words that might at least unlock some of these established positions. Am I completely whistling in the wind here?
I think you might be, Geraldine. These are conundrums that have echoed through the ages. And of course, we all hope that our own leaders are able to communicate effectively, crisply, clearly with their foreign interlocutors. But so often we find misunderstanding, misapprehension, and Tamerlane has outlined, I think, very neatly how it is that that can then ricochet down through the years as well. And we're often forced to unpick a variety of the misstatements and missteps that have happened in the past.
Let's move on to this sort of cultural capability that I know Tamerlane feels very strongly about, which you've alluded to already, and how someone like Australia, not burdened with all of these aspects of history, you try to train people to go into Asia in a much more imaginative way. What are the classic areas that you find in where people need help?
It's interesting because what we often find is people are terrified of causing offence. And they're so scared that they can't speak the language or they haven't studied a degree in the relevant area, and they're worried that they're going to do something terrible with table manners. But the reality is, the biggest misunderstandings are often happening because people aren't getting engaged. They're not simply engaging with people. They're not having conversations with people. They're not listening to the people they're engaging with. So what we find is that people who are really good at working across cultures are usually good communicators. They're good listeners. They have tolerance for ambiguity. They recognize they don't know anything, everything, but they're willing to have a go. So yes, you need to adjust your approach across cultures. But for example, I speak Thai. If I'm working in Thailand, it's pretty obvious I'm not a Thai person. I'm about a foot taller than most people in Bangkok. So people will recognize that I'm an outsider, and so they will adjust as well. So I think the key thing that we work with Australians on is, what do you need to adjust? What are the key points of difference?
Well, you say that, in fact, we're not interested in hierarchy. And this is something that is a real issue in the region around us.
And one of the things Australians do typically to demonstrate, to build rapport, is we undermine hierarchy. We make fun of people. So we use banter. So, and mocking humour of teasing someone else can be incredibly ineffective at developing rapport, but can also cause great offence. So one of the things about Australian culture, and this is also for people from the UK or the US, often find very challenging working in Australia, is that we don't like to use titles. If people expect to be called with a title, we'll usually call them by first name as a way of developing rapport, to make fun of them. So,
and that's not, you don't think that's wise?
It doesn't work. If people aren't familiar with Australian culture, they just think we're being insulting. To be honest, the key thing Australians need to do when they work in the region is understand hierarchy, show some deference to hierarchy, and understand the implications of that can make a big difference.
Does that sound reasonable to you, Nick Farrelly?
I think we all need to be working really effectively in these cross-cultural realms, and it's getting more complex all the time, of course, because we see the difficulties that emerge, especially online, when the cross-cultural communication breaks down. And there's a whole other dimension to the area where Tamerlane has been so effective in ensuring that we can have pan-political conversations as well, because we live on a planet where not everybody shares our values or necessarily understands our own preconceptions and starting points. And that will play out in all sorts of different ways. And if we're going to do well, we need to always keep that in mind. It requires empathy, and it requires a real sense of the fact that not everybody believes in the same things that we do.
I got a very interesting letter from a man called Mukul Desai, who wrote to us after I did a coverage of AsiaLink's survey about whether our top ASX 200 companies were ready for business for Asia. And in fact, they maintained that we'd gone backwards. And this is what he wrote, because he says he's done a lot of work in the region with short and long-term business opportunities. One fundamental issue dealing in Asia is that Asians have a culture of looking after their guests with over-the-top hospitality, taking them to nice restaurants, sightseeing, etc. This is not generally reciprocated by Aussies. In fact, I've heard stories of people coming from Asia who were left to their own devices in hotels at the weekend, not even providing a humble sandwich for lunch. Until Aussies learn to sacrifice some of their weekends and take extra trouble to look after their Asian counterparts, they're not going to develop that solid relationship, which is the norm in doing business in Asia.
That's a fascinating example, Geraldine. And I think what it demonstrates at its heart is some different values about what hospitality looks like. So from an Australian perspective, to say, if you have someone come to your house, you might say, oh, I've just got to grab something. The kettle's just boiled, help yourself. Whereas in most other cultures, hospitality means you serve somebody else. In an Australian context, we often say, we assume that people want to be independent and that they'd feel claustrophobic if we were looking after them all the time. So that's, again, an adjustment. And that's something when we work with our clients. If you have guests coming from the region, you need to look after them more than you would expect to. And to just say, oh, here's a map, we'll see you at 9 a.m. on Monday morning, which honestly the is the norm, can be shocking and confusing and terrifying for people.
It can be a bit tricky too, though, if you, like, for instance, I know in some parts of like places like Indonesia, if someone doesn't agree with what you've just said, they just don't ring you back. Like they say they'll ring you back. They just don't. So you're left wondering what on earth is going on. In fact, they don't want to say, gosh, I thought that was an idiot idea.
And that's one of the hardest things for Australians operating in Asia, is because we don't understand often that because of hierarchy, people won't say no to us. They'll just say, oh, that's interesting, or I'll get back to you. Whereas actually they're saying, absolutely not, forget it, it won't happen. So when you have relationships of trust, though, people will tell you what they really think.
You're listening to A Foreign Affair, if you've just joined us, our monthly get-together to talk about matters abroad. I'm talking to Tamerlane Beasley from Beasley Intercultural, Jamie Smythe from the Financial Times, and Nicholas Farrelly from the ANU's College of Asia and the Pacific. Now, Nick has nominated something quite challenging, some of the political challenges in Thailand, for instance, but the colourful life of the new Thai king in the midst of all of this. His lifestyle continues to make headlines, but not many Thais would see these stories because of the country's strict lese majeste laws. Here's a reminder of the death of King Bhumibol last year and the nation's new dynastic chapter.
For 44 years, he was Crown Prince Maha Wajiralongkorn. Now, after a regal ceremony in Bangkok, he's officially Majesty King Maha Wajiralongkorn Badindra Devaya Warangkun, or more commonly Rama, 10th king in the Chakri dynasty that dates to 1782. After weeks of uncertainty, the crown prince has formally acceded to the throne.
I accept the invitation in response to the will of the late king and to benefit the Thai people.
Now, Nick, what has been happening since that man became king amidst a range of trepidation, shall we say?
So what he's done, Geraldine, is he sought to stamp his authority early on the rest of Thai society. He's made some adjustments to the recently promulgated constitution, and he's ensured that he's now got all of the key positions locked down. The new king is spending a great deal of his time outside of the kingdom, and he's sought to guarantee that that won't undermine his position. His favourite destination happens to be southern Germany, where he's often seen out and about. There's no doubt, though, that he is a figure of some consternation for many people inside Thailand who just aren't sure whether he's going to be able to fill the very large shoes that his father, the former king, left behind.
Now, of course, we partly trained him at Duntroon, didn't we?
That's right. So he spent a year at the King's School and then came down to the Royal Military College in Canberra, where he spent about 4 years in the early 1970s. What that means is that plenty of people around a town like the one that I call home have their Crown Prince Wajiralongkorn stories. There's a fair appreciation for what he's like among bureaucrats, senior army officers and the like. And because he's become king, there's going to be an Australian dimension, no doubt about it, to his time on the Thai throne. Well, he's likely to make a visit at some stage. When he does, of course, there'll be all the pomp and ceremony. There will also be further attention, therefore, to some of the issues that have emerged during his long apprenticeship. There are plenty of people in Thailand who struggle to maintain affection for him based on what they've heard about how he conducts his personal life and how he treats the people that work most closely with him.
Have you seen, Jamie, some of the pictures that are emerging from Germany these days?
I've seen the crop top, and I've seen the photographs which show his penchant for poodles. Yes. So
and the low slung jeans. And
I'm wondering if he picked that up from Australia, actually, his time here.
Really?
But I mean, I think what's incredible about this is, you know, the monarchy is obviously a very unifying influence in Thailand. But Thai politics it's now an autocracy. I think it's been 3 years since the military took over. So we're entering quite...
They made sure they did not go into the palace grounds, by the way, the military. They did. You know, like they basically swept through, but they left the palace. I mean, it's always been a very, very delicate sort of dance, hasn't it, between the military and the royalty.
And I think that'll be the interesting thing about the takeover of the Playboy Prince. Can he keep that unifying factor? And where does the politics go from here in Thailand?
Now, Nick Farrelly, let's say he does come. He'll come with those laws in place. And there are a lot of people who will want to travel there, maybe. I mean, I think your concern is that it not censor us, that Australians ought to be able, notwithstanding what Tamerlane's just said earlier, to make their comments about lifestyle patterns or habits, principles or ethics that we really don't agree with?
Well, this is it, Geraldine. This is the hard edge of cross-cultural communication and political interaction at every level. We see it within the university swirl, but of course it really matters for governments, for business leaders, and for others who are seeking to ensure that Australia remains really close to our key regional partners. And this means we need to understand them. We need to understand them from first principles. We need to get to know them intimately. And yet, of course, in our own culture of political debate, there are almost no holds barred. It is rough and tumble. That's often difficult for people in a system like the Thai system to fully appreciate. And yet we need to work together with our collaborators.
How do we do it?
Well, I think we need to be open about where we stand, what we stand for, and how it is that we seek to carve out a common future and agenda, while also appreciating that there will be some points of friction. Those will be points of friction that we, though, need to manage in a collaborative style, a style, of course, with which Thais and many other Southeast Asians are very comfortable. Mm-hmm. So Australians need to step up to the plate in these conversations, make sure that we're doing so in a way which is culturally appropriate and which leads to those good long-term outcomes.
What I'm hearing Nick suggest is that we have to be able to state what it is that we have basic expectations of people in authority, and we have to be able to state that. Is it the way you frame it that we have to learn that, in effect, we're interested in Thai, in the future of Thailand?
I think one of the easiest ways to test whether something's a good thing to be doing publicly is to reverse it. So imagine, for example, if someone came from Thailand and publicly was criticising the role of the Governor General and the future republic in Australia and said what we should be from a Thai perspective, how we the Australian population might react to that.
Okay. Have you got any concerns for political stability in Thailand, Jamie, looking at this region?
Yes, I do, because it's a military autocracy. It's been there for 3 years. They're meant to hold elections and they haven't gone ahead and done it. But also the other issue is freedom of expression. You know, the Financial Times has a correspondent in Thailand. We have to be extremely careful with how we write, or that journalist could be put in jail. Other journalists have been put in jail. So I think Australia must, it is a difficult job to do. It's got to balance the interests of Australia. It needs to reach out to Thailand in terms of it being a partner in the region, but also it must stand up for, you know, its own principles and basis in human rights. I mean, if you look this week, the head of the spy agency of Australia was photographed fist pumping with Duterte. You know, that's probably not the best image to be showing around the region.
He wasn't alone, of course. Abe and others have done that too, but it was pretty challenging, I agree.
I think, you know, the Western world at the minute should not forsake its role in terms of promoting democracy and human rights around the world. And I think with the election of Trump, that is certainly down too low on the agenda of many countries.
Look, I just want to end with a sort of nice segue. What to do with difficult history in terms of the appearance that you do offer to other countries? And of course, I'm thinking about the Charlottesville and the business of Confederate statues and so on. And, you know, it's been some very interesting writing about how Germany has handled this, because Germany's had this terrible legacy to try to deal with. I mean, Nick, how do you, looking around the region, it's got all manner of different legacies, are they concerned about this at all?
Absolutely they are. And of course, many of the powers that be across Southeast Asia have sought to stamp out those inconvenient histories. And we've seen that in Thailand in recent times with the removal of a key plaque commemorating the 1932 constitutional revolution. And there are so many questions about what has come with that particular effort to delete, I guess there's no other word for it, an aspect of Thailand's recent history. All of this is very live. And I think those of us who believe innately in the value of liberal values, debate and a search for truth need to keep ensuring that these issues are brought to wider public attention.
Tam?
I think next year in March 2018, we have the ASEAN Australia Special Summit. So I think that's a really interesting opportunity where we have all the Southeast Asian leaders coming to Australia. Our governments are going to be engaging in dialogue. There's a business summit. So the region is coming to us. Mm. I think the conversations need to be continued within different spaces and in ways that are respectful. And I think what we need to also recognise is if you want to influence change, how do you do it? Because if you're just perpetuating your own way of communicating about things, you may feel good about yourself, but does it make any difference? So we need to be thoughtful around how we engage.
Yes. Jamie?
I suppose I'm from Northern Ireland, and there, you know, we've had a lot of...
yes, I forgot about that.
With a lot of symbolism and history there. And actually, Stan Grant wrote a very interesting column about Australia's indigenous history this week and the colonial history, suggesting that there should be new inscriptions put on some of the statues. I think one of the things I've learned from growing up in Northern Ireland is that it's very important to address history and to understand your history and to learn about it. And I think maybe in Australia's context, there probably hasn't been enough sort of understanding and teaching about the frontier wars. And I think that can only help rather than perhaps ripping down statues.
Yeah, it's a great article in the Washington Post by a woman called Yulia Komska saying, preserving difficult pasts calls for civic negotiation. That's what the Germans have learned. You can't just rip the whole thing down and just think that you erase the memories.
Absolutely.
But you've got to talk about it. Look, thank you all very much indeed. Nicholas Farrelly, Tamerlane Beasley and Jamie Smythe. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Tamerlane Beasley, she's a board member of the Australia-ASEAN Council for DFAT and the founder of Beasley Intercultural. It's a cross-cultural training and consultancy company. Jamie Smythe is the Australia and Pacific correspondent for the Financial Times. And Nicholas Farrelly is the Associate Dean at the ANU's College of Asia and the Pacific. And your thoughts, most welcome with, as I always say, thoughts about what you'd like to have discussed. So go to the website and you can see how you can leave your thoughts.